International House of Horrors.
Valued guests, and welcome back to the International House of Horrors podcast. Your sanctuary is spooky for all things terrible, horrible, brutal, bloody, gory, and the macabre. I am one of your curators here at the house, Joe Merle.
And I have a new microphone. Hi, Joe.
Yes. And Josh has a new microphone. Very excited about that. Your other one you had for a while, right?
Yeah, I've had it for at least like 8 or 9 years.
Shit. That's a long run on a mic, but that's good that it held up for that long.
Yeah, and it's still working.
You decided to... Right. So keep it as a backup in case anything ever happens and you need a backup microphone.
For sure,
but it's going to be good because with your new podcast venture, you know, the approach you're taking to that, I think the highest quality mic you can have is definitely going to help out because it's in depth. I wish I could understand German so that I could listen to that podcast, but unfortunately... This is one of those instances where I'm left out.
Yeah, you
that's
and all,
right.
all our listeners, basically.
Right, a lot
of German listeners out there. There will be a new podcast by me in like, I think April is the month I'm planning to start after I've done my vacation.
Nice. So in about a month, you'll be doing that. But for now, we're going to be doing this. We're going to be doing the International House of Horrors, and we've got the Twilight Zone to kick things off. Today, we've got episode 35 of season one. The original air date was June 17th, 1960, and it was written by Rod Serling, directed by Robert Parrish and Elvin Gazner. This episode is titled The Mighty Casey. It's got a very long opening narration, so I'm going to do my my best to get through all of this one, and then we'll jump right in and talk about the episode.
Yes.
What you are looking at is a ghost, once alive but now deceased. Once upon a time, it was a baseball stadium that housed a Major League Baseball club known as the Hoboken Zephyrs. Now it houses nothing but memories and wind that stirs in the high grass of what was once an outfield, a wind that sometimes bears a faint, ghostly resemblance to the roar of a crowd that once sat here. We're back in time now, when the Hoboken Zephyrs were still part of the National League, and this mausoleum of memories was an honest-to-Pete stadium, but once this strictly... Or wait, sorry, I screwed that up. But since this is strictly a story of make-believe, it has to start this way. Once upon a time, in Hoboken, New Jersey, it was tryout day. And though he's not yet on the field, you're about to meet a most unusual fella, a left-handed pitcher named Casey.
Yeah.
There we go. Kind of stumbled a little bit there, but that's all right.
That's okay. I'm not going to edit that out.
You better fix that, Josh. I cannot make a mistake. So this story we had talked about last week was roughly, roughly based on, but the title itself comes from the poem Casey at Bat. And, Casey at Bat, like I had said, I think it even had a longer name, like Casey at Bat, the something of the old Republic, some shit like that. This old baseball poem about this dude getting up and everybody, you know, he's the greatest baseball player ever. And then it turns out he ends up striking out. At the end of this, you know, the big moment when he was supposed to show up and win everything, Casey ends up striking out. So I don't see a lot of resemblance between the two. Maybe some things you could pull from one or the other. And this episode of The Twilight Zone, to me, is one of those episodes that I don't think aged quite as well as some of the others. And only because baseball at that time was everything. Like in the United States, you know, baseball was the sport. It's what everybody watched. You know, there used to be sayings people would say, well, you know, such and such is as American as baseball and apple pie. Like baseball was such a staple of the culture. Everybody knew it. Everybody followed it. And it's, you know, we still have, there's a lot of people who watch baseball today, but it's not quite the same as it was.
Oh, it isn't.
Way
I
back when
was
this
still
was
the same because like I went to the US, I'd watched a baseball game and it was like, one of the biggest things I've ever been to because there's so many people.
Oh, it's still, it's still huge. It is still huge, but now you have baseball, hockey, basketball, soccer, whereas I feel like back then baseball was kind of really it. That was all you had. Like, football hadn't taken off. You know, American football hadn't taken off. Hockey wasn't as big as it was. Basketball wasn't as big as it was. But baseball was the thing. That was like, you know, America's sport. Whereas now it's a little bit divided. So as many people you see at a baseball game, cause there's still a ton of people who love baseball. I'm not trying to diminish that, how big it still is. But you now have people who don't watch baseball at all. They only watch basketball. Or they watch basketball and football. Or you have people that only watch football but not baseball.
Okay,
get where I'm going there a little bit?
Okay, yeah, makes sense. Like, here, it's still mostly people watching football. There are other, like, our football, what you would call soccer, I guess.
Soccer,
yeah.
Yeah.
It's football, though. Yeah, but...
Right.
We are, like, in Germany, everyone watches football. And even the people who watch other things also watch football. I'm the only person I feel like who doesn't watch football at all over here.
Yeah.
And yeah, and so it's like that, like that is still here. It was back then, but now you have more.
Right.
Okay.
Exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
I got it. Yeah.
And we've got Jack Warden, who plays our title character in here, McGarry, and he has showed up in, I don't know if he showed up yet, but he's in a few other episodes of The Twilight Zone. I know that his face is one that I see. And really, we only have these couple of players. You got McGarry, Casey, and Dr. Stiltman, who, this is a great episode. I love the, you know, robot atomic age of early sci-fi.
I love how it's just glanced over that, like, oh, he's a robot.
I know.
Okay, then.
Right.
You managed to perfectly replicate a man who looks just like a normal human, and he's a complete robot. Okay, it happens.
Yeah.
People are smart.
And the so McGarry is the manager of the Hoboken. I think it was Hoboken Zeppers.
Yeah.
And they're pretty much the worst team in the league. It's brought to light many times. A win would be the odd thing for you guys. You know, you've lost 42 straight or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, he said.
And
he
so
said
you've
that,
got
like, if we win, we if one win is a streak already.
Right, yeah, one win is a streak. And we see these guys out there doing calisthenics, you know, can barely do jumping jacks. They make them look really, really poorly.
Yeah.
And so this doctor walks onto the field because they're having open tryouts. I don't know if we know he's a doctor right away, but he's like, hey, I got this pitcher that I want to show you, Casey. And he brings Casey on. Casey gets his chance. And I got to say, this is a very lighthearted Twilight Zone episode.
It's
like almost goofy in some of the, when the baseball hits that guy in the face and it's like bonk, like you get this really loud weird sound effect.
Yeah. And before or, that or also the when, sound effects when he just throws the ball, like he does the fastball on you and he the throw ball.
Yeah,
he looks at the watch and says, oh, he's a bit late with the slow ball. And when he does the curve ball, it like you don't
like,
see
woo,
it because they didn't have
woo,
yeah
yeah.
You don't see it, but you hear just exactly that sound, and it's like, okay, yeah.
Yeah, it's almost, I don't even know what they call that little instrument that people have that makes that sound.
Yeah.
It's got just the tiny little, it's like, I don't know what it is, but
I think it's kind
I know
of
I've
a flute,
played with one before.
Yeah.
But it's like a mix between like a flute and a kazoo.
Yeah.
It's a really weird sound, but yeah, he throws that curveball, and it's like, so you got all these funny sound effects going into it. And I love that guy getting hit in the face with the ball because he doesn't even move when it just hits him thunk, right in the head. So Casey comes out, and this Casey's a phenomenon. He's amazing. And McGarry's ready to sign him immediately. He's like, hey, we need this guy. You ready to sign 4 or 5 year contract, whatever the case may be. And that's when the doctor tells him like, hey, he's a robot. And
he just goes, okay,
they go to. Yeah, he's like, okay, don't worry about it. And the thing about Casey, though, is even though he's a robot, mentally he is young. He's only, you know, a couple years old from the way he explained it.
Yeah.
Like maybe two or three years old.
Yeah.
Yeah, and so the they give him the physical examination and determine that Casey doesn't have a heart. And so, therefore, he cannot play in the National,
because he's
the
not
National
a human.
Baseball League. Right. And in order to be human, you got to have a heart.
Yeah, that's such a funny discussion because he is a robot, but he looks like a human. So they say he's a human. No, he doesn't have a heart. He can't be a human. Okay, so if I put a heart in him, is he a human then? Okay, yeah, okay. And then he gives him a heart and
so he gives him a heart, and all of a sudden Casey has too much compassion. He doesn't want to strike people out. He feels bad because he's going to ruin their batting average or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, and he's actually planning on becoming a social worker now because he wants to help people.
Right.
It's like, and also the I love McGarry because he's just quipping all throughout the episode. I think
he
my
favorite good.
Part is when they say like he's not a human. He's he doesn't have a heart. He's not a human. And McGarry says like, well, basically doesn't have a heart, and he has like 40% of the whole company.
The whole right, team. Right.
Because yeah, he doesn't. Yeah, it's. I think he's really funny all throughout, and I really enjoyed that. But it didn't age as well. Also with the whole robot thing, of course, like it's.
That's the thing, yeah. The robot piece of it is because he even gives him the blueprints right away, and he's just like, "Oh, here's how I built him." And he starts to look over him right near the end. McGarry starts to look over the blueprints, and he's like, "Wait, wait, wait!" And he runs and goes to talk to the doctor. We're not given that information; we don't hear the conversation. But the episode ends with, well, McGarry went to Florida or wherever, created a team with some of the best teams ever or best players ever and took the pennant in this year, this year, this year, and this year.
Yeah.
So we're led to believe that McGarry took the blueprints and built an army of baseball robots to make the greatest baseball team the world has ever seen.
Yeah, and that's... I was thinking for a second when he left the blueprints there and we saw, okay, he's now going to pick up the blueprints. I thought there would be another twist in there. Or I thought before that maybe there would be a twist in there when he gives like... That would be, I guess, a typical baseball movie trope, right? He gives the speech and says like, he's getting his new heart right now, so we got to play the best we can. And I thought maybe he's not coming back at all and they're just winning now because they have the heart and are... better in the game or
right,
something.
Right.
That would be like the typical baseball trope, right? So he gives a speech and then everyone suddenly wins.
Really any sports movie trope.
That's true.
Not even just baseball.
That's
so
true.
Yeah, the episode wraps up right there. It's a fun, silly little episode, but again, it hasn't aged all that great. Some of these episodes are still really applicable to stuff we experience today, but this is, I think, Serling showing his lighthearted side.
Yeah.
And just having a little bit of fun with it and a nod to baseball, which again at the time was, I mean, that was it in the United States. And that's who this episode was originally done for US audiences. So they could relate to it. They all got it.
Yeah. And IMDb actually says that The Mighty Casey is the lowest rated episode of the first season. So, like, in general,
that doesn't surprise me.
Liked. Yeah.
Yeah. Although that doesn't surprise me.
It's still fun, though. Like, it's not like I would say, don't watch this. This is a bad episode. It's like with every episode so far, it's just, they're all...
This is like Twilight Zone mixed with, you know, Leave It to Beaver. It's almost sitcom-y in a way. A lot of the way they talk and the things that happen, you know, one weird circumstance after another continues to transpire. And we have to suspend all disbelief. Because McGarry was able to take those blueprints and build robots, baseball robots.
Yeah.
Probably with no experience whatsoever with building any sort of robot, the guy was able to make it happen.
And I
but
guess
overall, it is a lot
of
fun.
So that they were actually allowed to play. Right. So.
And where's he getting the hearts? You know, is this a Frankenstein thing? Is it a real human heart?
That's
who knows?
That's a good question.
So let's do the closing narration and we'll move on to the main topic for today. Once upon a time, there was a Major League Baseball team called the Hoboken Zephyrs, who during the last year of their existence wound up in last place, and shortly thereafter wound up in oblivion. There is a rumor, unsubstantiated of course, that a manager named McGarry took them to the West Coast and wound up with several pennants and a couple of world championships. This team had a pitching staff that made history. Of course, none of them smiled very much, but it happens to be a fact that they pitched like nothing human. And if you're interested as to where these gentlemen came from, you might check under B for Baseball in the Twilight Zone.
And this was the second to last episode, and next week is the last episode of season one. So we
Next week, the title of the episode is A World of His Own, and this one was written by Matheson. So this is another one of our Richard Matheson episodes. Which is exciting. So if you are following along, that will be the episode next week, the last season ender, It's going to be the first season ender. The end of the first season. There we go. And so that'll be a lot of fun.
On the Blu-rays, always at the end of each episode, there's like a teaser for the next episode that he did. And I don't know if I maybe understood him wrong, so I'm really excited for next episode because I think what he said is that Serling himself will be in the next episode as a part of it. So that's what he said. Like he said, and I'm going to play a part in it or something like that. Something to that.
Maybe he had a small little cameo or something because I don't remember him really showing up, but I could be wrong. I could be wrong. Oh, I see what they're going with. Okay, so we'll get to that next week, though.
Okay, yeah.
Just kind of flipping through it, and all right. So today, our main topic, you know what? I'll let you introduce this, because this is a topic that you brought to the table, I think, for good reason, and it's from your homeland.
Yeah.
So we'll give you the reins and let you drive this bus.
Thank you. So now I gotta look up the date again to say it exactly right, because this week, there was a 100th birthday. And I think it was the 26th of February. 27th of February, 1920. No, 26th was the premiere in Berlin. 26th of February, 1920. So just like as of recording right now, 4 days ago, it was the birthday, the 100th birthday of the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari, or Das Kabinett des Dr. Caligari. There, the German title isn't as different from the English one, actually.
Right, they're pretty much the same.
And I saw on YouTube that James Rolfe, one of my role models when it comes to horror movies, he made a video on it, not only saying that, this is the 100th birthday of this movie, but also, many people argue that this is the 100th birthday of the horror genre, of the horror movie as it is now. Because, and that's what we're going to discuss. We're going to talk about the movie, and we're going to talk about why it might be the 100th birthday of all of our favorite horror genre.
Yeah, it could be. And, you know, there is that first horror thing is always interesting,
yeah,
because it can be debated, because do you go back to the late eight, like, do you count the super short movies, you know, the little 1 minute, 2 minute things, but this is a full-length feature movie.
Yeah,
so this could, I don't know, I think you could make an argument that this is the first full horror movie, but you had all the little stuff, the late 1800s, but all that stuff was a couple minutes long. Yeah. You know, little one reel jobs,
and it was often like not as much what you would think of when you think of horror as this was. Like you had even Frankenstein in 1910 by Edison, which was like, I think, 40 right. minutes long. But even there, it wasn't as much horror. It wasn't really about scaring the audience, like, or making you feel uncomfortable. Like, well, they did scare the audience with like the train arriving at the station, because they all thought,
oh, right,
there's an actual train coming, I need to leave. But like, this was one that was actually just unsettling all throughout. Like even the Edison Frankenstein is kind of just like a fun movie to watch, but it's not really dark or unsettling. And what I heard a lot, why they say Caligari is maybe the first, is because of the German expressionism, the whole everything is
right.
like really winded and like what's the word again when it's like not straight, it's
you know, kind of offset, crooked, distorted.
Yeah, exactly.
You could use
it's all, and we're gonna get talking about that once we get to the movie. But so that's what,
and then
yeah.
Yeah, so you think about stuff, you know, A Trip to the Moon, and I want to say you're the one who told me about, what was the Haunted Castle?
Yeah, I think.
Was it you that told me about it was that little 3 minute from the late 1800s with some weird effects like ghosts and stuff,
yeah,
maybe?
Yeah, where ghosts and skeletons, there's a whole movie just called like Skeleton Dance or something, where a skeleton dances around. Yeah, and the Haunted
yeah, this
Castle
one,
is...
Yeah.
I think we're like, things move on it on their own and just like, disappear.
Right. But those are only a couple minutes long.
Yeah,
you know, they're only 2 or 3 minutes. So do you consider them a movie? I don't know. I wouldn't. But as far as traditional, I don't. And we've had the argument about what is traditional horror. Who knows? But yes, I would agree that Caligari, you could argue both sides of that. But I think there's great arguments on both sides. You can make a really compelling argument that it's the first horror movie.
Yeah, for sure. You could also say it's not there. There's probably lots of others. But yeah, it's both open for debate. And it's one that is never really going to be done. Because up to this day, we still
right.
each movie you can talk about, is it a horror movie or not? And there's people who will say, no, that's not a horror. That's a psychological thriller. Even with like... I've heard people call The Babadook a psychological thriller, even though like
right.
it's got actual like monsters. Because in the end, it turns out maybe it's not, but you know,
it's all in her head.
Yeah. And
now with Caligari, I will say of all the other aforementioned movies, this one has had the most staying power. People still know what this movie is. If you were to ask a handful of individuals, have you ever heard of this? You know, horror fans even. Have you ever heard of The Haunted Castle from 1896?
Yeah.
Well, maybe not. Have you ever heard of The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari? Of course.
Yeah.
Everyone's heard of this movie. It's there.
Although many people still haven't seen it, I think.
I think there's people who haven't seen it, but they know what it is. If you were to show them an image, they would say, yes, I've seen that. Or even, you know, Rob Zombie in the Living Dead Girl video pulled directly from The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. And then you had... the remake that I haven't seen, so I don't know if it's a direct remake, but I want to say there was like 64, somewhere in there, where there was another version of this movie that was made. Because it is so influential and, you know, super important.
Okay, yeah. So that remake, you told me about that when we started talking about the movie, and I had no idea. So I had never heard of it. So there's one from a TV movie from 1948 called The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari that, as far as I... Oh, so this was probably like... it's only 5 minutes, so it's probably like an introduction to the movie. Because also the poster is just the movie, the normal movie poster. Oh, here, 1962.
You know,
James
Carpenter. And then I'm seeing another one from 2005 that was directed by David Fisher. So there was and this one says it's a semi remake.
Oh, I've heard of this one. Yeah, with Doug Jones. This was like I think it was shot in like in a complete green screen, and they tried to recreate the movie basically, like shot for shot, just like with new actors and in CGI basically.
So again, I think that's just a testament to the staying power of this movie, is that people are still continuing to do stuff with it because it was so effective. And it still is. I mean, it's tough to figure out exactly what the fuck is going on in this movie.
Yeah.
You really can't trust. You can't trust any of your characters.
Yeah,
you're never given a really... I think we can spoil a movie that's 100 years old.
I think we can as well. Yeah, so the big twist that... So let's get to the twist at the end and just talk through the movie first, maybe, so that we don't spoil it right away. For anyone
who wants
to see it, we'll give a warning once we're getting to the end of the movie. But just watch the movie right now, then come back. I think it's 100 years old. You'll find it online.
Yeah, I think I watched it on Tubi. I think it's on Prime. Probably the whole thing is on YouTube. Yeah, you can get the Criterion edition of it. It is on Blu-ray and DVD. And I want to say the whole thing is probably on YouTube. Probably. I actually have no doubt... Oh, and you know what? I was just reading a little quote right here from Roger Ebert, who called it arguably the first true horror movie. Huh. So, yeah, it's there, man. It's, you know, it's a debate that's been going on for a long time.
Yeah.
And, all right, so let's talk about the movie itself.
Yeah, so...
You've got... Oh, go ahead. This is your thing. You go.
Well, I just wanted to jump in right away. We kick the movie off with, like, two people sitting on a bench... An old guy and a bit younger guy. And I think the old guy says something that he's seen ghosts or something. And then the younger guy starts telling about what has happened to him is worse than anything anyone else has ever seen. and he's going to tell the whole story right now. And then also a girl walks by and he says, this was my wife-to-be, but then this
my betrothed
horrible
yeah
thing happened.
And then we get into that actual story.
Yeah.
So and these two gentlemen are sitting outside, kind of idyllic. Looks like a park bench.
Yeah.
You know, there's flowers and bushes and things around. So they're just hanging out outside. And he said, oh, there goes my betrothed. I love her so much. We're going to be married one day.
Yeah. One question. Did you see the movie with English title cards, or did you see the German title cards with like subtitles?
Because I saw the English title cards.
Okay, are they... Because I've heard that often the English title cards are just like a normal text, because the German title cards are actually like wonderfully, like beautifully written, and they look just nice already.
And nice. Yeah, no, mine were...
Yeah,
mine were just the text.
Yeah, I'll send you a picture really quick of of some of the title. I took a few pictures because they looked so great. But yeah, if you can, I'd recommend watching the movie with the German title cards, because
with the subtitles.
Yeah, even though you're reading a subtitled movie, but I just sent you a picture of like how these title cards looked. They were like already.
Oh yeah, that's really cool.
Already in the style that of is the cool movie, basically.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah, and so that's I've heard that it's a bit different in the English version, where it's just like normal title cards, I guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're
You go on.
Okay. All right. So we're gonna actually talk through this story, and the story is a pretty easy one to follow for a long time, but then it does take some twists and turns. You're like, wait, what the fuck?
Yeah.
And it's still so effective even today. This movie still works on so many different levels. The standout, you had already mentioned it a little bit, but this was the birth of German Expressionism that would be taken on. I mean, without this, I don't think we would have all the noir movies that we have.
Yeah.
These kind of funky angles, these great deep shadows all over the place. So that is kind of the star to me of this movie. Like, the movie is great, but it makes you feel and pulls you into a place of mental distortion where nothing feels quite real. Nothing feels real at all throughout the entirety of this thing, and it works on so many different levels.
Yeah.
And it works really well.
At least what IMDb said. I'm not sure how true that is, but on IMDb, the trivia says that this wasn't as much German expressionism as it was born out of necessity, because this movie was shot in 1919, which was like right after the First World War. And yeah, Germans are known for starting the World War and then losing at the end, which happened after World War One. So German economy was at a low, so they didn't have much money. So what is really interesting is that most of the lights, you see, they didn't have money for all the electricity, so they painted the lights right onto the backdrops, and that's kind of what helped the expressionism, because they actually they painted how the light would fall onto the backdrops, so they didn't have to use lights, and that's
and it was clever.
Yeah, and that was part of what made this movie, was that like the backdrops looked kind of fake, but also in a way really good and interesting, right?
Well, and I think it lends itself well once we get to the end of this movie. It all makes a lot more sense, and you're like, holy shit, like that's really good.
Yeah,
so
that's why I think
we've
got
this
just out of necessity, but what is actually planned to be this crooked and weird,
right? And so we're in the flashback where you've got Francis and his friend Alan. So Francis was the one we saw at the beginning who says, I'm going to tell you this story about all this stuff that happens. They see this woman. We see that it's the woman who passed by earlier while they were sitting on the park bench. And they say, oh, we both love her. Whoever ends up with her, let's just still be friends.
Yeah.
It's kind of great. And now there's a fair coming to town. And that's where we're introduced to Dr. Caligari, who is played amazingly by, what is his name? Werner
Krauss? Yeah, Werner Krauss.
Werner Krauss.
Yeah.
Krauss. So he's seeking a permit to do his show during the fair, or to bring whatever his, and I don't even know how you say that word.
Somnambulist.
Somnambulist?
Somnambulist. Yeah.
Okay.
Also, I love that this already, like, in this German expressionism horror movie from 1920, we still see German bureaucracy at its best. When, like, we have this villain of the movie is titled after him, and he goes to the city to ask for permission to have his stand with his somnambulist.
Yeah.
Somnambulist, which is just, like, I think it's another word for a sleepwalker, is what I've heard.
Right. Yeah. I was kind of just looking at the on Wiki. It says sleepwalking, also known as noctambulism.
Okay.
Noctambulism is a phenomenon of combined sleep and wakefulness, classified as a sleep disorder belonging to the parasomnia family. It occurs during slow wave sleep stage in a state of low consciousness. So, yeah, sleepwalking.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And he seeks permission, and I didn't fully understand, did he get the permission or was he just brushed off and then...
The guy kind of like gave him shit about it, was like giving him a hard time.
Yeah,
like,
saying like later.
I don't know if he told him. Yeah, I think he gave him the permit, but he like made fun of him along the way.
Oh, that might
like,
be
he,
it, yeah.
Yeah, he gave it to him, but then was like, nah, get out of here, you crazy asshole. Like, you can have your permit, but you're stupid.
Yeah.
And then that guy, that very night, the clerk who had given the permit, we find out is dead. And he's been murdered in his bed or in his sleep or something like that.
Yeah, and we don't know who it was yet. We're left in the dark there. We just hear, okay, there's someone murdered. And then we go on to the fair where our main guys, Alan and Francis, which, by the way, it's so interesting that in this German movie from 1920, these guys have all these American names, because even in the German version,
right,
they are Alan and Francis. It's not like they put them into English or something. No. I mean, the actors are called like Werner Krauss and what's the other one again? Because he's also Konrad Veidt. Those are their names, but the characters are Alan and Francis, and isn't the girl called Anne or something? No, Jane. Even worse. Jane.
Yeah.
So they're all like really English names, and I wonder why that is. I gotta find that out. Even in the Nosferatu, they're all like Harper and that's the only name I can think of right now. But they also have like
I don't know if they were doing it for hopeful to have success overseas.
Maybe, yeah.
To be more accessible to an English audience that wouldn't have to try and dissect these different names. And also at the same time, just coming out of World War One, do you want all your characters with German names?
Oh, so...
You know what I mean?
Yeah, that might be... Yeah, that's a good idea.
Because there was probably still distaste for Germany across most of the globe.
Probably.
And so giving your characters different names would help people, disassociate and remove that German component from the movie that they were watching.
Yeah, that is true.
And we got to say that Konrad Veidt was also the man who laughs.
Yeah.
You know, he would do that 8 years later, which is amazing.
He's also...
No one's ever seen that one.
He's also later on in Casablanca. He's the major.
He's the guy with the opposite. He played a lot opposite Bogart in that one.
Yeah, and...
Which is good.
And he is in... Waxworks, a horror movie from 1924 that also stars Werner Krauss, that I just did worked on for my podcast, my new one. So just
the one that only our German listeners can listen to. But that's okay. So we've now got Caligari's got his stuff set up. He's like, hey, I'm going to wake this guy up. Is that when he first wakes him up, or he starts doing the... He has the poster or the banner on the thing.
Yeah.
And he's like, hey, I'm going to wake up. What's his name? Caesar or something like that?
Yeah, Cesare, I think. Cesare, maybe. I don't know how it's said. Yeah.
We'll just say Caesar for the lack of really knowing what it is.
Yeah.
C-E-S-A-I-R-E.
Yeah.
So who knows?
Cesare.
And they're asking him questions, and Alan asks him, how long am I going to live? And he says, only until dawn. And Alan's like, what the fuck? Like, what do you mean only till dawn? Like, this ain't right. Why? Yeah. What's going to happen to me?
That's like kind of dark. That's also a question I wouldn't ask someone who knows the future. I don't want to know when I'm going to die. Like, how long are you going to live? Well, 25 years and 5 minutes. Oh, shit.
Right. What do I do now?
Also, I love before that, he presents the somnambulist and says, like, that's actually the scene I just sent you is the text, because I just love that text in general. It says, like, 23 years old, and he's been sleeping for 23 years with no stop, day and night. That's like, I would love to do that, just like sleep all day.
Just take some nice long naps.
Yeah.
And so later on that night, we get Alan ends up being murdered. So now we've got a couple murders going on in town, and the people start to get worried. I think this is where we're introduced to the police, where we see the investigation start.
I think we kind of, I'm not sure. I think we might have seen like a short snippet of them after the first death message, but not
murder.
Much. But now we see them actually like looking more into
right.
it. Also, we got to say, we see Alan being killed, like, almost on screen, like with shadows.
Yeah,
it's a really
which
cool
is a really
scene.
Cool effect.
Yeah,
it was a really cool effect, really well done. And I love this movie so much. It still works so well. But I think about the people who were creating this movie. Like, can you imagine being in that world? Now we have, you know, we live in the digital age where you could keep filming for as long as you wanted. You can do green screens. You have teams of, you know, 1,000 people helping you make an Avengers movie. It's one guy's sole job just to touch up colors. It's another guy's job to do this. These guys were like rebel filmmakers trying to figure it out as they went along.
Yeah.
Like, holy shit, we can only film for 15, 20, 30 seconds at a time. That's the most we can do before we got to swap out a reel. We don't know what to do with the lighting. We're not even 100% sure where to put the cameras. Yeah, we can't get a light. Just paint that fucker on the wall. Who cares? Paint a light. Like, it would have been really neat to see how this all actually came to be. There was no blueprint yet. They were helping build the foundation for everything that would come. So it's really cool. It's important. It's really important.
Yeah, that is true. And we get a scene later on that James Rolfe talked about, that it's like he's had it, that scene, like, we've seen that scene so many times since. But we'll get to that later on. Where this movie is actually really influential in all the movies that came afterwards, in just like single shots where it's just like a scene that we see copied time and time again.
Right. They did a great job, man. So we're back to the movie. We now have Alan is really trying to figure out what happened to, or Francis trying to figure out what happened to Alan.
Yeah.
So he's working with Jane. He talks to Jane's dad, who's a doctor, and says, hey, we got to figure this shit out. Jane's dad gets permission from the police to investigate Dr. Caligari, start trying to look into this guy. Because, hey, how did this thing know that he was going to die by dawn?
Yeah.
You know, like, is there a true fortune teller? Is there not? So they start to dig into what's going on a little bit.
Yeah, exactly. And they're trying to find it out. And that's when we get the scenes where he's like looking into the window of Caligari, and he's like just sitting there and opening the coffin. And this is one scene where he's feeding Cesare or Caesar or whatever, which looks kind of funny, but also kind of scary. Like this whole movie. By the way, Caesar looks really like kind of imposing. Like
he's almost like a Anthony Perkins type character. He's not very big, but he's slim. But there's something where you almost could go either way with him.
Yeah.
But the way Caligari, like you said, at the feeding scene, the way when he sets him up and like pushes his back up and then is just putting food in his mouth, it's really bizarre.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, and so now you got to help me. You just watched it, right? How does it go on? I'm stuck there. So
when they catch that other criminal. Remember, there's that guy walking down the street, and the guy peeks out the window, and he says, "It's the murderer! It's the murderer!" And so they take this guy in, and this guy's a piece of shit, too. He says, "Well, I was going to kill this old lady. just taking advantage of the situation.
Yeah.
The fact that there were murderers going on, I was going to kill and rob this lady and then blame it on the other murderer. And he's like, but I promise you, I had nothing to do with those other two murders, but I had every intent of, and that guy was really creepy too.
Yeah.
He looked, you know, he was real gnarly looking.
He looked like a killer, yeah.
Yeah, and so we're not revealed the box yet. We see after that is when we see the shadow figure, the Caesar character, going into Jane's house.
Oh, yeah.
When he sneaks along
the walls and like leaning on the wall.
Yes.
He's even walking in he's sleepwalking. So, of course, he's walking in a weird way. But yeah, that scene looks amazing.
Super creepy. Yeah, because he's got his arm upstretched behind him and he's, you know, his back is pressed really flat against the wall.
Yeah.
And he's creeping almost like a shadow. The way you would think a shadow would move along the wall if somebody was standing in front of it in that same position. He looks like this shadow figure. And then you get this long shot of her bed and him way off in the background, slowly moving into the foreground closer to her bed.
Yeah.
That's really good.
Which is a scene that a similar scene we got in Frankenstein later on, where the monster climbs in through the window when Frankenstein's wife is like getting ready for the marriage, maybe when she's in the mirror making her makeup, and then Frankenstein's monster walks in. That's like a very similar scene where it looks like similar enough, and
it looks it's you know, like a strange shadow. I don't even know how to describe it. You just got to watch it.
Yeah, exactly.
It's amazing.
And then he comes in and he's about to kill her. Like, he has the knife in hand, puts it up, and then like he sees the beauty of the girl and falls in love, basically.
So he grabs her and tries to run away with her. He takes her, runs out into the street, but he's getting chased by an angry mob. During the commotion, the other individuals in the house wake up. They start chasing. They bring some other people. So you've got all these individuals chasing. He eventually lets her go, and then he dies right after that. I want to say after he drops her, she gets free, and then he dies? He collapses? I know he falls over, and that's when they go back to Caligari's little trailer, which I love the look of Caligari's trailer.
Yeah.
With the fence along the side. It really feels like an old sideshow trailer. And they go in and realize that the Caesar in the box is a dummy. It's not really him.
Yeah.
And so they take that out, and in the scuffle and struggle of everything, Caligari ends up taking off. You know, he pushes his way out, and you get this really cool chase scene through all these. When we say the views in this movie are distorted, they are fucking crazy distorted.
Yeah.
Like, you'll see a cityscape bent over, almost on a curve of sorts. And the roads are all, you know, sideways. No path goes straight. Everything veers to the right and then a hard, you know, angle, hard 45 to the left. And so you get this really fun chase sequence of them trying to get to Caligari.
Where you're almost like worried that someone might just trip over like a wall that's standing somewhere distorted or like maybe just accidentally running into it. Because, it all looks kind of just off and wrong, like in a dreamlike way almost. It looks like in a dream, you could say.
Absolutely. Like, I would agree with that wholeheartedly.
It looks like in a Tim Burton movie.
Because that's a good way to put it. In one of his, you know, Nightmare Before Christmas, where everything has the very weird angles, all the buildings are very weird shaped. Even in, you could say, pieces of Beetlejuice, it's there. A lot of, you're right. I think that's a good comparison.
I think Tim Burton really loved the aesthetic. Yeah. Also.
Yeah, he must have, because it's all there.
Just to rewind a little bit, Caesar stealing the, falling in love with the girl and capturing her. That's something, that's like the start of a trope that we saw like all throughout the 30s and 40s and 50s and all throughout, actually. Like with
all the monsters, monsters falling in love.
Yeah, King Kong, Frankenstein's monster.
The Gill Man, creature from the Black Lagoon was in love. You could even say, you know, not so much in love, but some sort of infatuation with Norman Bates and Psycho.
Yeah,
you know, he became infatuated with Marion Crane in the same way. You're right. That's a trope that's going to continue on for time and time again. All the way up to the newest thinking, I'm just trying to think through stuff, but the newest Friday the 13th, or even the old Friday the 13th, it's like, looks like my mom. Where not so much love, but the creature has a turn of heart.
Yeah,
I would say,
and that it's one of those tropes. Also in I think Texas Chainsaw Massacre, especially Texas Chainsaw 2, he's like completely in love with
he's in love with Stretch. Yeah,
and it just,
even though he doesn't know how to show it, he's just rubbing her thighs with a chainsaw blade.
That's not how you show a woman you love her. That's how I always do it.
Yeah, that's how I always do it. I go get my chainsaw out and gently caress her thigh with it. But you're right. That is a big piece.
Yeah.
So now we've got Francis is digging, starts digging a little bit deeper, and this is where the movie starts to take a turn, and you're like, wait, what? Like, what is happening here? So Francis goes to the hospital, and he says, I want to look into a patient that you've had here.
He follows Caligari up to the end and sees him walking into the insane asylum. And that's when he follows, and then he goes in and says, this guy just ran in here. Maybe you've heard of him. His name is is he going for Caesar or is he going for Caligari? I'm not sure.
But I thought he was going for Caligari.
Yeah, right.
But I can't remember because they say they give him the direction. We can't reveal patient information. You need to talk to the asylum director.
Yeah, exactly.
And that's when he goes up to the asylum director, walks in the room, and sees that the asylum director is Caligari.
Yeah.
And he's like, what the fuck is going on? And that's where we, as the audience, are saying the same thing.
Yeah.
We're like, okay, wait, this is really kind of crazy. And is that when the cops show up and they start digging into the journals?
Yeah, exactly.
When they start looking at all the writings?
They bring in either the body of Caesar or maybe the puppet, I'm not sure, but they bring in Caesar. And then he goes crazy, and that's when they find all the old things that Caligari was actually like a guy.
He had these old journals, and he was trying to do the same thing.
Yeah, exactly. Because Caligari was actually someone like a few hundred years ago who went from town to town and killed people with his somnambulist, and so. Director, he actually waited to get somnambulist to his place, and once one arrived, he said, "Oh, finally one arrived. Now I can try if this really works." And that's when he went to the city to try it out.
So that's when he goes, and we even get a little flashback of Caligari. I love that sequence. It is amazing where you get the text. When he's outside, like, I must become Caligari, and you have the words appearing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's super cool. He's out in, looks like on a path next to some trees somewhere, but the words Caligari keep going, like his descent into madness, like it becomes his obsession. And he just sees Caligari.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's really, really good.
Yeah, and I don't fully know how they did it. I'm guessing they just wrote it on paper and put it in front there, but it looks perfectly, and he's never he always moves that he's right close to the text, but never behind it, because then we would see that the text is not actually on top.
I'm sure it was just a clear film cell with writing over top of it. Somebody hand drew all that shit on there.
Yeah, probably. It was amazing, and just like the letters popping up everywhere, and he's going there, and he's going where other, and always he sees the "Du musst Caligari werden," which is actually really fun. Before the movie was released, they put up signs just saying that sentence all over Berlin.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
that's fun.
Didn't say what it was for. Like, this was like marketing before there was real marketing.
Yeah. And it's now we're back in the, not in the present, but we're back in the flashback present, I guess is the best way to say it, where they go into Caligari's office, they show him Caesar's dead body or his corpse, whatever you want to say, and that's when Caligari kind of goes nuts, attacks one of the staff members, and then they throw him into a straitjacket, and he becomes an inmate of the asylum.
Yeah.
And now we jump to present. And this is where that amazing twist to all this comes in.
Yeah,
you want to talk about twist endings?
Yeah.
this really is a good one.
So if you haven't seen it, just stop now. Watch it if you still haven't. Because if you haven't seen it, we don't want to spoil the twist, but there's a twist ending to it. The movie still works if you know the ending, but the twist ending is awesome.
I think it works even better if you don't know the twist. You're right. If you've never really seen this and don't know it, I would encourage you to stop listening now. Watch the movie. It only takes an hour. And then if you want to come back, if not, we'll only be talking for a couple more minutes about it anyway. But enjoy that twist ending. So here we go. Now we'll talk about that twist ending. And it is a really good one. We see Francis is an inmate of the asylum.
Yeah.
And we see Jane. Jane is comatose for the most part. She thinks she's some kind of royalty or something like that. And
we see
the other
Caesar.
Gentleman that Francis had been. Yeah. We see Caesar over in the corner. And so we see all of these characters as crazy people.
Yeah.
And with Caligari actually being the director of the asylum.
Now he looks a bit cleaner, though. He's clean shaven and he
looks. He's very
better.
Very cleaned up. And then we see Francis attack Caligari. He's like, it's him, he's doing this. And they restrain Francis and then put him in where Caligari was. I assume it's where Caligari was. The same room,
yeah.
Right. And they say, okay, now that we understand what's wrong with him, maybe we can cure him.
Yeah.
You know, once he's there, now that we get it, maybe we can find a cure for this guy. So what that does to us as the audience, we can't believe anything that happened throughout this entire movie.
Yeah.
You don't know what's real or what's not. You cannot trust your narrator. Your narrator has been shown to be a crazy person. So it gives you the ability to walk down so many different avenues. Is this guy really crazy? You know, did he end up here as a result of the events that happened? Is Caligari getting away with this? Is this guy a full-blown nut? Did nothing actually happen, and he just manufactured this whole scenario in his head?
Yeah.
You really don't know, and I think that's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's a great way to end this movie.
Yeah, you really... It might be all just in his head. It might just be a crazy story. But also, it also now explains why everything looks so weird in the whole movie. Because it is told from the perspective of a crazy person. So, of course, like, everything is kind of off and weird. It's...
Right.
It's just such a great
movie. Yeah, it really is. And it's wild to think that it's 100 years old.
Yeah, 100 years old and it's still...
I mean, it's crazy, man.
Yeah, and by the way, this movie was lost for a long time. Like, I think until the 50s, they thought everything was lost. And then Werner Krauss came out and said that he still had a print. And
Nice.
Yeah, and I think then it was stored, like, in the German Cinemathek. And it was just, I think, if I remember it right, it was just released in the 90s again. That was the first time it was released.
Interesting.
Again.
Yeah.
And it's like,
even though they did that version in the 60s, I want to watch that one from 2005.
Yeah.
Even though it doesn't have very good reviews, I still want to check it out.
Yeah. Also, it's got Doug Jones, and I love Doug Jones.
I know. He is wonderful.
And
I want to see.
Go ahead. He's Caesar, so that's probably going to be great because, I can really see him as Caesar. He's like the same kind of long person with like long limbs.
Right. So this one has an 8.1 on IMDb. I want to look at what it's got for Rotten Tomatoes.
Is it even
because
Rotten Tomatoes? Isn't that like...
No, Metacritic is the one that doesn't go back.
Oh, okay.
Rotten Tomatoes will sometimes go back even based on modern reviews. It's got 100% on Rotten Tomatoes from 51 total reviews and an 89% audience score based on almost 28,000 reviews. So it still holds up.
Yeah.
It's amazing that it still holds up the way it does.
Movie? Like, you're not going to watch it if you say, I hate silent movies or I hate German movies. You're not going to watch this at all. And if you do like horror movies or if you like movies at all and you watched it, how can you not like it?
I don't think there's any reason you couldn't enjoy it because it really is just so well done. So good call, man. Good call on this week. I think it's a great movie to celebrate. I love that I had the opportunity to go back and watch it again, you know, because it's one that I'll watch here and there, but I like it when it's like, okay, sit down, really watch this thing,
yeah,
see it for what it is, and try and find something you haven't seen before. And there's just so much great. And it looks like they made the whole thing an estimated budget, granted it's IMDb, but $18,000 made the entire movie,
yeah,
which is amazing.
That's crazy. And yeah, that's why they like had to hand paint all of the sets, because they didn't have money
for right.
the sets.
And didn't have any money.
It looks just awesome. And yeah.
So that's it. That is The Cabinet of Dr. Caligari. Definitely check it out.
Yeah,
check it out, man.
Watch it.
Yeah, if you have not seen this, do it.
Yeah.
Even one of the reviews, I'm just looking on Rotten Tomatoes here. One of the audience reviews says, I'm not a big fan of black and white movies or silent films in that matter, but this one really got to me. And that's what I think this one does. Even if you don't like those kind of movies, it still works on so many different levels. Check it out. Give it a watch. Dr. Caligari is a must. Mm-hmm. And happy birthday, Caligari.
Yeah, happy 100 birthday.
Years. That's, you had a good run.
That's a good age.
Yeah. Not bad. So that's it for us this week. If you want to get into contact with us on social media, it is at IHOH Podcast, or you can email us, IHOHpodcast@gmail.com. If you would jump on Apple Podcasts, leave a rate and review. It would be greatly appreciated. And for the International House of Horrors, I've been Joe Merle.
And I've been Josh.
And we'll be back next week with more things terrible, horrible, brutal, bloody, gory, and the macabre.